Hi, it's Diane. Great to be back with you. On my mind this week, the Nunez memo and how the Trump administration is politicizing law enforcement. My guest this week, David Frum, says his biggest fear is that actions like these are changing our country.
What we have most to fear is slow decay. Donald Trump is not the heart attack of democracy. He is the gum disease of democracy.
Then,
women are speaking up. They're having their voices heard. I think they're being believed a lot of times for the first time. And yet, this is all about structural problems.
A look at where the Me Too movement is headed. First, I talked to Jessica Bennett, gender editor at the New York Times. And I check in with a woman who's running for Congress in New Jersey, part of an historic wave of female candidates. First, here's David Frum, senior editor at The Atlantic and author of the new book, Trumpocracy, The Corruption of the American Republic. David Frum, it's good to hear from you again.
What a pleasure to join you.
Thank you. Give me your assessment of the President's State of the Union address. What stood out to you?
What stood out to me was the lack of any attempt to move the country. Donald Trump is speaking at a time of great prosperity in the United States. The country is at relative peace. You would think this would be a moment to try to reach out to a broad audience on behalf of a policy agenda that could reach people who are not part of his core constituency. The model of how to do this is Bill Clinton in 1996. Bill Clinton had some political troubles. He had lost the House in 1994, but it was a time of rising prosperity. His poll numbers were increasing. And so he took some issues that were of appeal to the middle of the country, welfare reform, some law and order issues. He filled his own content into them, and he made what is probably one of the most effective State of the Union speeches of our time, and it certainly helped to reelect him. Donald Trump didn't do anything like that.
It was interesting that he did not veer from the prepared speech at all. Were you surprised at that?
You know, I think Donald Trump gets these sort of graded on the curve that when he behaves in any way that in any other president would have been considered minimally adequate, he gets points. Presidents don't veer from the text of their States of the Union because these are very carefully considered documents. They also usually contain a lot of material, too much material, so that if you start ad-libbing, there's a risk that you will overspill the time. And Donald Trump delivered this massively long speech. Improvising is not your friend if what you're trying to hit certain time deadlines. But the fact that he's on relatively good behavior today doesn't tell you what he's going to do tomorrow.
That brings me to your new book, Trumpocracy. Tell us what you mean by Trumpocracy.
Well, we're all mesmerized by the outsized personality of Donald Trump. But what interests me is Donald Trump's power. Trumpocracy is a system of power, and the book is a study of that system of power. How does Donald Trump do it? He doesn't do it by standing on a stage and giving orders. He does it in partnership with the executive branch, with Republicans in Congress, with the Republican donor elite in the country, and with millions of rank-and-file supporters. The book is a study of why they support Donald Trump, why he has not been checked, what he's doing to American institutions, why the institutions are vulnerable, and what can be done to protect them.
You're also talking in the book about how he's gained power, how he's used it, and why he has not been effectively checked. Why do you think that is?
Well, let's do a compare and contrast. Jimmy Carter, who was a Democratic president, of course, had a Democratic Congress all 4 years. Bill Clinton, a Democratic president, had a Democratic Congress for his first 2 years. Despite having a Congress of his own party, those two presidents were checked in all kinds of important ways. Donald Trump is not checked by the Republican Party, I think for this reason. That party is now advocating an agenda that is pretty unpopular in the country. Most of the things that Paul Ryan wants to do are things that wouldn't pass a poll test, and that a normal president wouldn't sign because a normal president would be worried that it would compromise that president's hopes of being reelected. Donald Trump will sign Paul Ryan's bills. Paul Ryan, in return, will give Donald Trump protection against financial investigation and against Russia investigation. And that bargain has lasted for a year. Paul Ryan got things out of Donald Trump. He got him to sign a very, very unpopular tax measure. He got him ready to sign the repeal of Obamacare, which would also have been very unpopular. And in return, Ryan has worked to shut down and the Russia investigation, to discredit the FBI. He's allowed the head of the House Intelligence Committee, who's supposed to be was once a highly honorable position, a committee that operated in a bipartisan way to understand threats to the United States and to oversee intelligence agencies, and they've turned into Donald Trump's PR squad.
So how long might that bargain last? What is it that could break that bargain?
My hypothesis in the book is the bargain's only going to get stronger because the Republicans are likely to take some losses in 2018. They may lose one or even possibly both houses of Congress. And as they do, Donald Trump will become more important to the party. He'll become a more important political asset. He will have to be protected. And as the Mueller investigation goes forward and as we learn more about Donald Trump's history and background, he will become more vulnerable. So I think the bond is going to get tighter as Trump gets weaker, not stronger.
It's interesting. You write that since 2000, democracies around the world that once seemed strong have been in retreat, and since 2016, now our own as well. What's happened?
We came through this democratic zenith in the 1990s. Central Europe, South Korea, Taiwan, the spread of democracy through Latin America, Chile. And it looked at that time, I mean, we all remember the power of that moment as if this was the future. But beginning in about 2005, the number of democracies peaked and began to go into reverse. And a lot of countries that looked like reasonably stable democracies began to lose some of their democratic characteristics. I'm thinking here of places like the Philippines, South Africa, India, sadly. And now it's come to the continent of Europe. Hungary and Poland are looking like they're going backwards. There's a Trumpist party that is the second biggest party in the Netherlands, as consolidated and stable a democracy as there is. And the most alarming backdrop to all of this is basing here on research by the Harvard political scientist Yasha Monk, that if you ask people in democratic countries, is it essential to you to live in a democracy? Among those born in the 1930s, almost 90% say yes, it's essential. But among those born since 1980, only about a quarter say it's essential. There is, and when you ask the question in other ways, you get similar kinds of answers. What we are seeing is a loss of commitment to this form of government among younger people across the developed world, and thus the rise of characters not just like Donald Trump, but like Law and Justice in Poland, like Viktor Orban in Hungary, like the National Front in France, like extremist parties across the world.
So what is it that we have most to fear from a Trump presidency?
What we have most to fear is slow decay. Donald Trump is not the heart attack of democracy. He is the gum disease of democracy. He will, to protect himself, he will begin by trying to politicize law enforcement. We're seeing that. A director of the FBI fired and then a deputy director forced into retirement. We have seen him try to mobilize the Department of Justice to investigate his defeated political opponents in the last election. We've seen him working with Congress to compromise and discredit an FBI investigation into Russian penetration of American elections. So first step, the politicization of law enforcement. The second thing to fear is a continuation and acceleration of tampering with voting rights at the state level. I think a lot of Republicans have concluded, you know, it's true, our ideology is very unpopular, our policies are very unpopular, and one thing we might do is amend those policies so that people will like them more. But another thing we can do is to let fewer people vote, because then we can have unpopular policies and still win.
You're presenting a pretty pessimistic view. But surely there are institutions that can theoretically keep his power and what he is doing in check. Are there not?
There are, and we're testing them. some institutions are passing the test, like the federal judiciary, like the traditional press. Other institutions are failing, like the executive branch, like Congress, and the new media, which have become tremendous enablers of Trump-style disinformation. And not just Fox News, but a whole satellite of extremist radio stations, extremist social media. But I am not a pessimist. I mean, I think there are signs of optimism. But the places to look are not the institutions which are sometimes holding, more often buckling, but the spirit of the country. The most heartening thing to me about the Trump era has been this incredible rise in civic engagement that I've seen, and anyone who travels around have seen, and people who've never been involved in politics before, people who are putting aside maybe some of their past commitments to work on the most important issue of the time. In 2014, we had the lowest voter turnout of any election since 1942, when millions of men were overseas. 2016 was, again, a low-intensity election where a lot of people said, I don't like either choice, and you know, I'll vote listlessly or won't vote at all. But in 2017-18, we're seeing energy, and that may reinforce the institutions.
Now, what about the power of women in this whole anti-Trump movement? You're seeing the response to Harvey Weinstein. You're seeing people saying, what about the president himself?
I think that's a big part of it. That is, of course, one of the places where Donald Trump's support has been declining fastest, not just among college-educated women. I'm talking about white women. Not just non-white women didn't like him before. But non-college white women were seeing a rapid slide in support for him. I don't want to go into anybody's head, but it may be this is something more general than simply specifically the Me Too movement. I think it's having to look close up at someone whose organizing principle of life seems to be cruelty. It's something that just a lot of women recoil from.
What did you think of Melania Trump as she sat watching her husband deliver that speech this week?
She obviously is somebody who is full of discontent. She could not bring herself to applaud. She arrived at the Capitol in a separate car. She made a bargain. I think she made it understanding what the bargain was. But it's the human nature that even if you think you know the price of the bargain in advance, when the price is actually presented, you begrudge paying it.
David, you say that President Trump is first and foremost a kleptocrat. What do you mean?
Donald Trump is not someone who, he doesn't like to be disagreed with, of course, but he is not a systematic authoritarian leader in the way that, say, a Vladimir Putin is. And of course, America is not Russia. Donald Trump's first impulse in getting into power was to get rich, to protect himself from the legal risks of the way in which he got rich. And that required turning off a lot of the burglar alarms that we have in American democracy. It meant putting an end to a lot of financial disclosure requirements. That's why he won't release his income taxes. They would show things that it would be damaging to him to have seen. That's why his disclosures, his financial disclosures, have generally been so inadequate. We know very little about Donald Trump's debt. We know about his personal debt, but the debts of corporate entities in which he has an interest, we know very little about that. According to the best biographer of Trump and Trump's finances, Tim O'Brien of Bloomberg News, Donald Trump has dozens of special purpose business vehicles that exist only to hold debt. We know very little about those.
So what's happened to the ability of the press to go after all these questions?
Well, there's a limit to what the press can do. The press doesn't have subpoena power. The press, the traditional press, I think, has done a fabulous job in the time of Trump. Unprecedentedly so. One of the things that I made it as a resolution when I started writing my book was whenever I relied on the work of anybody else, which I did often, I would not just follow the traditional convention that you give credit to the institution that published the work. I would give credit to the individual journalist because the work has been so hard. But what I quickly discovered is in the Trump era, because the president says so much that isn't true, journalists at the New York Times and the Washington Post and Reuters and other places, they will interview 40 people who know something about this. And no one journalist can do that. So you have teams of two and three and sometimes four journalists. And so when you give credit to the story, it's not just, you know, Jane Robertson or Joe Bloggs. It's, you know, Jane Robertson and Joe Bloggs and sometimes one or two others. So, but they have done incredible work. They found out a lot. But in the end, the press can't make anybody answer a question who doesn't want to. Only Congress can do that.
Well, it's so interesting because we are getting leaks from the White House, even from people who then continue to collaborate right. within the White House. So that you have to wonder what it is that's going on within their minds.
I have a chapter about these leaks because they come at a cost. One of the things that Donald Trump has done is he has triggered in the federal government, and especially in the national security apparatus, an autoimmune disorder where you've got this dangerous presence, beholden in some way we don't fully know to Russia, beholden in other ways that we don't know to financial interests, with a long history of shady or worse financial practices. And so agencies like the National Security Agency and the CIA and the FBI, they all, like a piece of grit in the system, rebel. But what they then do are things that are also dangerous. I mean, a lot of the leaks that have shown us the connections between Trump and Russia have come about by people with highly classified information giving away classified information that tells the country the truth, that gives the country a warning, but that also compromises the future intelligence gathering capabilities of the United States. Concrete example, Michael Flynn, the first Trump national security advisor who was beholden to Turkey and Russia, was a completely unsuitable person. He was forced out by leaks that showed that he had lied about his conversations with the Russian ambassador. But those leaks also revealed that somebody in the U.S. government was listening to conversations that the Russian ambassador thought were secret. Well, presumably, the Russian ambassador will never use that means of communication ever again. That channel of information is now blocked as a price of saving the country from Michael Flynn as national security advisor.
All right. So if in the end we hear the report from Mr. Mueller, and that report is extremely damaging to the President of the United States, what do you think could happen?
I think what could happen is that Republicans in Congress will, as they have done till now, take the information on board and then say, we don't see the need to do anything about this.
But suppose the Democrats do take back the House in 2018 and the balance of power is shifted.
We will have a, this will be a tremendous political fight. Because let me make a prediction here of what I think is the likeliest outcome. I think what Mueller will find is that, I mean, we know so much of the story already. He will find that there were people very close to Trump violated laws, federal election laws, and they violated laws about registering as a foreign agent. Those will be technical violations that will involve people near Trump, but not Trump himself. And I think a lot of people will not find them so shocking. The shocking violations will be the degree of complicity between the Trump campaign and WikiLeaks and behind WikiLeaks, Russia. And although that will be shocking and anti-democratic and unpatriotic, I think we'll discover that a lot of the worst actions there are not illegal because the Trump people are right when they say collusion is not a crime. A lot of things that are horrible aren't crimes. It is not a crime for an American political campaign to sit down with a foreign agency and say, let's work together to defeat our opponent. It's un-American. It's undemocratic, but it's not criminal. And we may be in a situation where the Republicans in Congress and their friends in the media are saying, okay, maybe you shouldn't have done these things, but there's no crime. Therefore, there is no remedy. And that will be a huge political battle.
It strikes me that what you're talking about, David, is the breaking down of the very fundamentals of our democracy. Is Donald Trump intent on doing that?
I don't think he has any deliberate plan to do that. It's more, you know, he ended so many speeches when he was campaigning with a story that had as its punchline the phrase, "You knew I was a snake when you took me in." He told us what he was, and we knew it. He cannot abide any kind of restraint, of morality, of law, of anything. And he will break any restraint, not because he's got a plan to do it, but because he can't help it. What he needs to survive is the destruction of institutions that protect the rest of us. we're either going to retain a Donald Trump presidency or we're going to have the rule of law in this country, because you can't have both.
You do write that Donald Trump has also given us some gifts. What are they?
I think they're the gift of wider vision. There are many issues that he talked about that were unfortunately invisible to many of the leaders of the country. Donald Trump was the candidate who in 2016 talked most about the opioid epidemic. Others gave it short shrift. Donald Trump was the only candidate to acknowledge, of the 16 on the Republican stage and of all the candidates on the Democratic side, that immigration has costs to native-born people as well as its benefits to the immigrant. He understood at a deep level that something had gone very wrong in the economy for middle-class families. So he gave us a wider vision. He's giving us this gift of civic engagement that I've mentioned already, of people caring more. He's reminding us of the preciousness of truth. Post-truth, that phrase we hear so much, began in the universities as a compliment, as a way of saying, you know, you transcended these outmoded ways of thinking that there's truth and falsehood, and we now have many different truths, as Oprah said at the Golden Globes. But what he's teaching us is the opposite of truth is not truths. The opposite of truth is lying. And lying is dangerous to democracy, and truth is precious.
Will his presidency have a long-term effect on this country?
It could, especially if it's two terms. I think a lot of people, especially on the Democratic side, expect the Trump presidency to collapse all by itself, or there'll be some impeachment mechanism or something will come along to rescue the country. I'm not so sure about that. And what I see in a Democratic Party is one that is being driven by the needs of the 2020 primary fight, being driven to places where the voters won't follow it. If the Democrats do well in 2018, they get optimistic about 2020. This is going to be a fight between Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren as to who can be lefter than thou. And that pulls the whole Democratic Party into a place that makes Donald Trump more electable in 2020, especially if we assume prosperity, than he looks today.
David Frum, I really want to thank you for being with us today. Thanks so much.
Thank you for the hospitality.
Now a quick break.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily. Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
And we're back. Now we're joined by Jessica Bennett. At the end of October, she became the New York Times' first ever gender editor. Since then, she's contributed to the Times' reporting on the fallout of the Harvey Weinstein scandal and the rise of the Me Too movement. Jessica Bennett, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Tell me how you would assess the Me Too movement at this point.
Well, I think that I'm simultaneously heartened and surprised and feel like, you know, this was really a long time coming. The sheer number of cases coming out now shows that women have existed and silently suffered with a lot of this behavior for a long time. I also, as a journalist, have been almost surprised that there doesn't seem to be any fatigue around this. People are not tired of hearing these stories, of reading these stories, of learning more. And so I'm monitoring that and wondering what the next stage will be.
Are we seeing something of a backlash?
You know, I almost feel like I've heard more talk about this potential backlash or questions about it than seeing actual backlash. I think it's really important to have these conversations. You know, I think people have rightly raised the question of there is a variety of behavior that we're talking about, and there's a spectrum, and it ranges from Harvey Weinstein on the very extreme end with a pattern of rape and sexual assault, to some of these other cases that were, you know, bullying in the workplace. But there seems to be only one punishment for a variety of crimes. And so that's some of the criticism, and I guess you could call it backlash, that I've heard that I think is an important conversation to have.
Yes, I also wonder about the question of age and whether women of different ages see this issue in very different ways.
You know, it's been interesting. I'm sort of in the middle in the sense that I've talked to a lot of younger women in their early 20s. I'm in my mid-30s, and then I've talked to my mother's generation as well about this. And I do think that there seems to be some difference in the way that we view some of the subtler behavior. So we all heard about the story of Aziz Ansari a couple of weeks ago. There was a piece published in a magazine called Babe, in which an anonymous woman who went by the name Grace accused him of sexual assault. And what she described was something that I think some women have called a bad date. They had dinner. They went home together. They engaged in a variety of sexual acts. She didn't feel comfortable. She, through both physical and visual cues, but also verbally, expressed her discomfort at various points. And then eventually she said no, and he got her a taxi and she left. But the use of the word sexual assault to describe that, I think, has prompted a lot of discussion and a lot of debate about how we think about that word and how we think about that behavior and how we talk about the issue of consent. And I do think that for younger women who have many times gone to colleges where this type of training, consent training, learning how to say yes and no very clearly when engaging in sexual acts has been mandatory in some cases, has given a broader perspective of some of these issues that perhaps my generation even doesn't understand.
I'm glad you brought that up, because it does seem as though for some young women, certain behaviors are totally acceptable, and they do understand when and how to say no clearly. And yet some in the middle are not quite sure. Let's talk for a minute about the workplace. There have been some articles recently about men being fearful of taking younger associates or colleagues with them on trips when the younger colleague may have done all the work to prepare for the trip because the gentleman does not want to be seen traveling with this young woman and somehow getting into a position of being accused of something. So talk about the workplace and what's happening there.
I think that what we're seeing, you know, there's a lot of behavior that I think for a long time was somewhat accepted at work. And whether that was, you know, comments or, you know, making it clear that you couldn't be alone in a room with a woman because might be perceived in the wrong way, that are really coming to the fore. These are things that are being debated, and we're sort of striking this no tolerance policy. You know, that's no longer okay. But many have also raised the question of, okay, so what then happens if men are too fearful to say anything forthright to a woman that they work with, or too fearful to be alone with a woman that they don't then mentor her? And that's concerning. You know, women struggle to find mentors. What we know is that mentorship and sponsorship are really crucial to anyone's success at work, men and women. Women already struggle to find these mentors. And what we know already from some economic research by, I think, Sylvia Ann Hewlett, is that men already fear mentoring women and don't want to be alone with them because they're afraid of how it will be perceived. So certainly we can't get to a place where, you know, we're physically dividing up men and women at work. We have to work together and we need to be able to communicate and we
Indeed.
Need to be able to do business.
Sure.
So I don't know what the answer is, but I think we have to have these conversations openly. And I think there has to also be some ability for error. I don't mean sexual harassment is okay, but I mean that we should be able to have these uncomfortable conversations and ask questions. You know, I think men should feel comfortable asking questions and talk about these things in a way that can hopefully lead to progress.
And so far, we've heard from many, many powerful women, but what about the men? Don't we need to hear from powerful men as well, speaking out on this issue to somehow educate, inform, instruct other men as to what behavior is appropriate?
Absolutely. You know, at the Golden Globes, we saw all of these celebrity women wearing all black, and we saw a lot of men wearing these Time's Up pins, which was great, except that none of the men were actually talking about what Time's Up was. Only the women seemed to be talking about it. And the reporters on the red carpet were asking women about the Me Too movement and about the pins and why they were wearing black, but they weren't asking those same questions of the men. And my feeling is that, we'll get nowhere if we can't talk about this between men and women. Like, we absolutely need men to be part of this conversation. We also know that most sexual harassment trainings simply don't work. But bystander intervention, the idea of somebody intervening in a situation, which men have a lot of capability and capacity to do, actually is the one thing that's been proven to be effective. So I think that as we move forward and as people get more comfortable talking about these issues, I really do hope, as you said, that we'll hear powerful men speaking up as well.
You know, I've been interested in the last week or so to see the spotlight come back onto Woody Allen. Mm-hmm. I wonder what your thoughts are there.
I think that for a long time, Hollywood has done this thing where they've kind of turned a blind eye, or people get upset for a time being and then we all forget about it. And that's not happening here. That's not happening now. And so I think that this conversation has finally come back around and we're sort of hearing the arguments on both sides again. And I think that that's really important. I also think that some women and men are making really important decisions about what they will lend their money to. You know, will you pay to go see Woody Allen movie? Will you buy the new R. Kelly album? Like, there is a lot of power in withholding financial resources and sort of selecting pieces of culture that you know you want to contribute to financially. And so I know a lot of my female friends have made the decision not to put their money in those places.
Interesting. You know, we had Rebecca Traister on a few months back, mm-hmm. who said that things won't change until Me Too translates into political power. Do you think the same way?
I mean, it certainly seems that politics is the one place that has been kind of immune from this movement, you know, all across media, across entertainment, Hollywood, in factories, in corporate offices. We are having these conversations. There are horrendous cases coming forward, and men are being removed from power. But the great irony, of course, is that there is a president who's also been accused of sexual assault, who seems unscathed. And so I think that at this point, where the movement needs to go, or where I hope it does go, is that it moves to change. You know, women are speaking up. They're having their voices heard. I think they're being believed a lot of times for the first time. And yet, this is all about structural problems. These are about institutions and large webs of people who were complicit in many of these cases. And so in my mind, the next stage of Me Too is thinking about change. What is changing? Is anything changing? Asking the question of how we actually can achieve change. And is that through the political system? Is that through organizations? Is it through HR departments? It seems like it's not through HR departments from what we've seen so far. As in so many of these cases, it's actually HR departments that worked against victims. So that's what I'm monitoring closely and very curious to see how it unfolds.
Well, Jessica Bennett, I want to thank you so much for joining us. You've been a great help. Keep doing what you're doing.
I will, and you too.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
My next guest is 29-year-old Lindsay Brown, a first-time candidate. She's running to represent New Jersey's 7th District in Congress. Lindsay Brown, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Tell me why you decided to run for Congress.
I decided to run for a few reasons. It was really a matter of building reasons until it got to a point where I couldn't ignore it anymore, and I really felt that I had to run. But ultimately, it started with hearing the statistic that women need to be asked an average of 5 times before they'll even consider a run, whereas men wake up in the morning and look in the mirror and think, I could be governor. So that really got me angry and got me thinking. But ultimately, the final straw was when Mitch McConnell had Elizabeth Warren leave the Senate during Jeff Sessions' hearing and said about her that nevertheless she persisted. And that really resonated with me because that is the experience of being a woman, is we have to be persistent in order to get anything done. You know, as the saying goes, well-behaved women rarely make history. And I realized that, you know, activism, while it's really great, and calling my congressman, while it's part of democracy, was not getting enough action done. And I felt that the best way that I could get involved and be part of the change that I wanted to see was to run and actually be that change.
Good for you. And tell me what you hope you can accomplish.
Well, I hope I can get into office in the first place. That's the first big accomplishment, is getting elected.
Sure.
Because I'm running against a very well-heeled and established incumbent. So the primary itself is an uphill battle, and getting the votes to get into office is enough of a challenge in the first place. But should I be elected, which would be fantastic, I would really love to have a strong hand in overhauling our country's education system. For all of the social issues that we're seeing, all of the economic issues that the middle class is experiencing, it's really all a result of the fact that our education system has been failing us on a large basis. There are a lot of countries that are far ahead of us in terms of the quality of their education system now. Their education system starts earlier. It doesn't involve the same amount of standardized testing, and it allows for far more opportunity in terms of future careers for their students than our system currently does.
Tell me where you are hoping the money is going to come from.
That's a great question. I think that the current tax plan that just went through at the end of last year, cutting all of the corporate taxes the way that it did, does not set us up for bringing in the kind of revenue that we need for basic government services such as education. And I would propose shifting around the tax burden a bit so that there is a bit more tax burden on corporations once again, but in exchange, I would want to take more of the tax burden off of individuals, including those who earn more than what's considered middle class, because we can't just tax the rich to pay for the poor, because that's what breeds a class resentment.
But, you know, it doesn't sound as though you're running as a traditional Republican. How do you fit in your own views with those of the current administration and the current Republican Congress.
So my views do converge somewhat with the current administration insofar as even in Trump's State of the Union this past week, he wants to pour money into infrastructure. He wants to lower drug prices. He wants to, you know, improve treatment programs and such for the opioid epidemic. You know, these are more moderate proposals that I can align with. I don't agree with much of what Trump did campaign on, especially his more divisive rhetoric, but he has put forth some more moderate and even progressive proposals that his own party doesn't necessarily agree with. And where my own views square with the current Republican administration in Congress, they really don't. And the current Republican administration that's in Congress has diverged largely from not only the true base of the party, of people who really consider themselves to be Republican voters, but the party in its identity in total. You know, the Republican Party used to be the party of Lincoln and Roosevelt and Eisenhower and Rockefeller. You know, the National Park System was created by a Republican. The EPA was created by a Republican. The National Highway System was created by a Republican. A Republican freed the slaves. And these are all things that the party needs to come back to and remember its true heritage.
Well, you did participate in the 2017 Women's March. Do you think that that's going to endear you to other Republican women?
I hope so. I know that a lot of conservative women don't feel that they had a home at the Women's March, which is really a shame because the Women's March was not just about these progressive policies. It's really about giving women the same kind of equality that we really ought to have at this point. And I think even Republican women can respect that, even if they didn't feel welcome at the Women's March. And my goal as a Republican woman and as a feminist, I'm not afraid to use that word, is to make the country a better place for men and women.
Good for you, Lindsey Brown, and I wish you all the best. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And that's all for this week. I'd love to hear what's on your mind. Connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org, or leave us a voicemail. The number is 202-854-8851. And go to our website, dianereen.org. Our theme music was composed by Cliff Harden. Comes to us courtesy of the Capitol Soundtrack Project here at WAMU. The show this week was produced by Sandra Baker, Rebecca Kaufman, and Allison Brody. Our engineers are Jake Cherry and Natalie Urib-Livker. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehn.